Tonight we're going to start a different study. We finished up Daniel last time. And so if you have a Bible, if you'll open to the book of Esther. Now, if you don't know where Esther is, go to the Psalms and start flipping backwards. Or flipping towards the front of the book, rather. And once you get to Job, you know you're close. And after you're done with Job, you should find Esther pretty easily. Or you can go past 1 Kings, 2 Kings like we did before, go to Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, and then go to Ezra and Nehemiah, and then you get to Esther. What? Oh. Huh? Did I say Nehemiah? It's after Nehemiah. I'm sorry. So anyway, is everybody there? It doesn't really matter because I'm not going to go there just yet. Anyway, we're going to get a little background of this thing. The reason we're going to the book of Esther is because we've been following the chronological story of the Israelites, and they've gone off into exile, and that's the reason we went to Daniel, is because that was kind of the story that we have of Israel while they're in exile in Babylon and the influences that were there. And so Esther kind of lets us linger our last little bit in the exiled area before we head back to Jerusalem when they go back. It's an interesting book. Esther's a very interesting book in a lot of ways. You don't actually find a lot of people preaching on it. You know, if you go to look for other resources or see, what other people have to say about it, you'll find that your pickings are slim at that point because nobody really likes to mess with this book. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know that this is a book that people really work overtime to try to pietize. I don't even know if that's a word. I asked somebody before. I don't know that it is. Is it a word? Can we use it? I'm good? Okay. Seriously, the efforts are downright heroic of people that try to take this and try to wring some sort of godly intent, to try to turn the people in the story, like Esther and Mordecai into people of faith and integrity. The problem with that, the real difficulty that we have in doing that, is that the Bible just doesn't present it that way. It doesn't actually show these people as being really all that good. Now, don't get mad at me, but the thing is, I really believe that we have to come to grips with what this story is really about. And part of the problem that's developed over time is that we've kind of turned it into a romance story. It's been kind of the popular fodder for romance stories. And I don't know that that's really what's being communicated in all this. I mean, this is a story about a Jewish family that did not go back to Jerusalem with Ezra when all the exiles were heading back into Jerusalem. God had commanded them, go back home now, the exile's over. But there were quite a few Jewish people who actually stayed behind, who decided they were going to find their roots and settle down in what is now the Persian Empire. That's no longer the Babylonian Empire. So these are people that stayed behind in Persia to find a life outside of God's original purpose for them, outside of God's intent for them to be in Jerusalem. It's an interesting thing. It's an interesting view into a unique period of time for these Jewish people, especially the people that were left behind after the exile was over. I have to be honest, as you read through this book, and you may find or take issue with me on this, but as you read through this book, you are not necessarily going to find Esther or her cousin Mordecai overtly godly people. As a matter of fact, you will never once in this book find either one of these two praying. Esther will never pray to God in this book, in this account. You'll actually never hear God mentioned. He doesn't come up. This is the one book in the Bible where God, the author of the whole story, never even makes an appearance, as far as we can see. But that's the thing that I think is interesting about this, because I believe that this is a story. This is a book that is really, in reality, about people who are unfaithful Jewish people. There are people who are going off to find a life that was distinctly different from what God had originally intended for them, trying to find a life in this world, in Empire Earth, and how things kind of pan out for them, what ultimately they learn about finding a life in this world, what it means and what comes of it. And we find that these people are people who are delivered by God. We have to insert by God, because the text doesn't necessarily state it overtly. but they're people who are delivered in spite of themselves. There are people who enjoy a deliverance from God based purely on grace and not necessarily their own merits. Now, like I said, you may take issue with my view of this. We're going to go through the text. We'll read it. We'll look at it. You may see it differently. But my goal, my purpose in this is not to try to twist these texts to mean something that we assume from a predisposed idea about what's going on here. I want to read these texts and see what they're really saying, see what's here, and see what we can learn from it, because we can, I believe, look at this almost parabolically. We can actually see ourselves in this text if we look carefully enough. But as we go through this, I want to just warn you up front, this is not going to be heavily godified, because the text itself isn't. What we're going to do is infer from this what God is up to and what God's doing as we look at it. Now, Esther's actually considered one of the favorite books of the Jewish people. It's read aloud to every family every year in the Jewish holiday of Purim, which is celebrating the deliverance of the Jews from the Persian plot to destroy them. It reads almost like a fairy tale. I mean, you've got a common girl who's going to become a queen. You've got an evil villain who hatches this wicked plot to destroy people. You've got the clever resolution, and justice is served in the end. And it's all, it's all the elements of almost every Disney cartoon that's ever been made. I mean, as we look at it and as we're going to uncover it. And so it's a very interesting story. It's a great read. And if you'll indulge me tonight, as we read it, we're going to keep that in mind, that this is to be read like a story. This is to be read like the story that it is. So with that introduction, we're going to begin by reading the first 9 verses of the book of Esther. So here we go. Chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, that was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the 3rd year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen, of purple on silver rods and marble pillars. And the couches, were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking wasn't compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palaces, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Okay, now Ahasuerus, or Ahasuerus, is actually, in our historical understanding of the events, is King Xerxes, the Persian emperor. He's very well documented in history, and we believe this is who this is at this time. Xerxes has been in power for about 3 years now. It says in the 3rd year of his reign. He succeeded his father, Darius I. So this is roughly late 400s, 480-something B.C. Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, is just now getting ready to plan a massive invasion of Greece. The Athenians have become a thorn in the side of the Persians. They actually undid some of the things that the Persians were doing over there in that region. And so to get back at them, they decided it was time to mount an all-out assault on Greece. So the Persian-Greek wars, under Darius had come. This is not just any ordinary party, because it lasts for 6 months. I mean, this is like a serious, full-on party. I mean, no one parties like the Persians can party. But so, figure a half a year. Now, you can figure that the idea behind this, why he's doing this, is he's wanting to show off all the power that he's got, show off all the riches of his kingdom, because he's got to get as much support as he can for this mounting military campaign. So it's a very, you know, it's a clever tactic on his part. We can assume that what's going on, since the timing is there, though the text doesn't necessarily say it. You know, you could think of it, if it is in trying to get, you know, the support and everything that he needs from the rest of his nobles and from all the provinces, you could actually think of it as like a 6-month long pep rally. You know, go Persia. And the idea, you know, you thought pep rallies in school were long. This is 6 months. Because the idea is they want to get everybody on board and all on the same page to go do this. So after this party comes to its conclusion, it says that he throws another party, a much smaller event, which is only 7 days long, and it's for everybody. This, the other one, the first one was for all the nobles and all the people who are in power and all the provinces there, but this one is for everybody. All the commoners, everybody in town is invited to a big bash, and you know, they have that over there by the royal palace. And there's you know, there's a huge buffet and the wine is flowing, but it's not compulsory. You know, you kind of wonder what's that whole deal about. But we believe that in that time period, if you were going to go into the king's court, it would have been compulsory to drink the king's wine. You wouldn't refuse something that the king is offering. That would have been an insult and could have been punishable as treason. So in this case, he's just saying, you know, let everybody, you know, choose. And if you don't want to booze it up, that's fine. You don't have to do it. And we get all these details of the color of the drapes and all of this setup and all the luxurious and an abundance that's there, because he's wanting to send this message out. You know, he is the most powerful man that's roaming the planet at this time. He is the head of one of the greatest empires that the world has ever known. It's a gigantic empire. He masses one of the largest armies the world had ever seen at that time to go on his quest against Athens. Now, it says here that Queen Vashti, his wife, she also throws a party, but it's just for the ladies. And her job, we're assuming, is to, you know, wow the wives of these men, because, you know, they need to be on board with all of this, make sure that they're behind their husbands as they send them off to war. So this is the kind of the concept there. That's the setup, that they're having this big party, and it's going great. Everything's going really well. The queen is throwing her party to get everybody stoked and happy about what's going on here. But now the first domino in our story is going to tip, and we'll see the succession of events that develop after this. So verse 10, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Bitsa, Harbana, Bigtha, which Bigtha was the cousin of Big Freeze, Abagtha, Zetar, and Karkas, seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Okay, so the king calls Vashti to come. You know, the end of 7 days of partying, and it says that the king's heart was merry with wine. Now, I don't know. That seems like an understatement to me. 7 days of drinking would seem like it would produce more than just a good buzz. But either way, who knows? I don't know. It just says that his heart is merry with wine. The words are in a very positive sense. I mean, he's obviously feeling good and feeling sure of himself. And so he calls for Vashti. And her name literally means beautiful. So he calls for beautiful to come. And basically, the idea is he wants her to show off, you know, her beauty before all of the people that are assembled there, all the guys that are there, the people that he's been drinking with for 7 days. And he wants her to bring the crown. Now, this is, again, a curious incident. We don't know exactly what this is all about. There are people that have proposed all kinds of different scenarios here as to maybe this breaking protocol, that this wasn't something that he was supposed to be doing. He wasn't supposed to call for the queen this way. Again, we really don't know, and history's pretty much silent on the subject. We don't know. You know, the fact that it puts that qualifier in there, that he's been drinking, seems to lend itself to the idea that this was outside of normal protocol. You know, well, we'd all been drinking. It seemed like a good idea at the time. I don't know. But I think the idea behind it is that it's something that does seem to be outside of the normal way in which a king should be dealing with his royal wife. whether this is him just being drunk and saying, hey, baby, come in here, bring that crown with you, or something like that, or whether it's Jewish tradition actually says that he was in an argument with all the other princes as to who was the most beautiful in the land. That's Jewish tradition, and it was the result of this argument that he decided to summon his wife to show her off to everybody else. But why she refuses to do it is another big question. We don't know. You know, Xerxes is clearly wanting to show off his possession here, but what happened there between the king and the queen that caused her to refuse this command? Again, the text doesn't provide it for us. History isn't very clear on what the protocol would have been. All we know is that she was summoned, and for whatever reason, she decides not to come. She sends back the message, I'm not going to do this, which then reveals that Xerxes is actually a mean drunk, because he says as he gets mad and he actually gets furious. He starts raging around. And you can't understand. I'm not saying that it's excusable, but I'm saying that as we look at it, he's just been embarrassed in front of all of his princes. I mean, his wife has embarrassed him in front of all his buddies. And so, you know, as king, he's, angry at the situation. And so they've got to try to come to some sort of resolution here. So we go on to verse 13. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice. Those closest to him being Karshanah, Sheth-ar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsanah, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and who ranked in the kingdom. What shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs? And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she didn't come. This very day the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they've heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it won't be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. When the king's decree, which he shall make, is proclaimed throughout his empire, for it's great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. Good job. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, of course. And the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in his own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master of his own house, harumph, and speak in the language of his own people. Okay, so this is the setup here. The king, it's interesting to me that in the face of what is clearly a deep insult, the king doesn't actually just have her executed. He doesn't just say, oh, well, off with her head and we'll move on from there, which hints that she was probably from nobility. I mean, there's more than likely, and again, I'm reading into this, but it's more than likely that there are, foreign relations are at stake, are tied to this to some degree. It hints at that anyway, because of his response here. So he gathers his think tank together to try to figure out what they're going to do. How do we deal with this situation? This is, what are the ramifications of her disobeying me in front of everybody? And what are the ramifications for the kingdom? What should be the ramifications for her for doing this sort of thing? So one advisor, Memucan, gives his opinion. The queen, in his opinion, did wrong. And she, she was not just refusing a king. I mean, her husband. I screwed that up. It wasn't just refusing her husband. She was refusing a king, which brings this into the realm of treason. I mean, this is something that has to be squelched. You know, the ramifications of that are pretty severe. Because of her prominent position, she ends up setting an example and could become a precedent for other people in the kingdom. Now, they keep this centered around households, husband and wife relationships, but the ramifications reach farther than that. Someone is able to disobey the king with such insolence, it sets a precedent that they weren't going to allow for. And so his point is that if we don't deal with this decisively right here and right now, well then, you know, it's going to lead to all kinds of problems. And again, he puts it all in the realm of this patriarchal concept. You know, all the women folk is going to get all upset and be emboldened to refuse to obey their husbands. And we can't allow that in the Persian Empire. So Memucan says that this ancient women's liber needs to be replaced by someone, he says, in his words, someone better than she is. And what he means by better than she is someone who's going to do what he says and not stand up for herself. Now, we have to remember, again, we have this tendency, and I know there was a movie made about this book not too long ago, and we have this tendency to kind of read modern value systems into the thing and even try to read in certain piety and godly suppositions into it. But let's remember the time frame in which this book is written. I mean, let's remember the time frame. This whole Bible is written. This was a hard time for women. This was a difficult thing. I mean, this is misogyny on parade, and that's the world in which the Bible was written. It really is not until the influences of the kingdom of God through Jesus Christ come into this earth that things begin to change. It's not until the message that the ground is level at the foot of the cross is there that sense of equality that's birthed a world in which we live in today. Had it not been for the kingdom of God, that's why I absolutely adamantly oppose anyone who tries to say that Christianity is some sort of misogynist religion. It is not. If it's properly understood, it is the very thing that provides the equality that we enjoy to this day. That's the very thing that laid the groundwork for that made that possible. You go to any nation that's outside of the realm of a Judeo-Christian influence, and you're not going to find those kind of rights for women. You're not going to find the proper treatment of women. And we've talked about that before. It's a dangerous place for women in this world. And so it's a wonderful thing. You know, the seeds of it are in the Old Testament. Joel made a prophecy, Joel 2, chapter 2, and he said, I'll pour my spirit on all flesh. Your young men will prophesy, your old men will dream dreams. But he says, I'll pour it out on the men and the women, both the young and the old, the men and the women will be involved in this. And, well, that was unheard of in that time. The seeds of it are through the Old Testament, but it didn't come to fruition until the kingdom of God came. But so in this context, let's understand what we're looking at. This isn't a commentary on right or wrong. I believe it's horrific the way that she's being dealt with, the way the king is dealing with her. But God is going to work his purposes out, even in the midst of a very corrupt, very evil culture and society. Things fall into place, and God does what God is going to do even through the evil actions that men will perpetrate. And how that works, please don't ask me, because I don't know. Somehow he's able to do that. Somehow he establishes his will in spite of what man is intent on doing. And nobody does what they don't want to do. No one is forced into anything. That's just the way God does stuff. Okay, so they go ahead and make this, you know, everybody likes his line of thinking. They're saying, this is a great idea. I like this. And so they decide they're going to make this a law of the Persians and Medes. And remember, the Persian Empire was, this whole governmental concept was founded on the idea that the law is everything. Basically, the law is God. It doesn't get changed. If you put it into law, it's not going to get altered. It's not going to be done away with. And so he's saying here, let's put it in the law that she is ousted. You know, she's going to be banished from the royal court. She's no longer going to be allowed to be the queen. And then we're going to make an edict saying that all the men have to be rulers of their households, which by implication means all the women folk got to get in line. And so that's how this ends. That's how this chapter ends. And so we let the camera fade to black, and there's a little bit of a pause, and then it fades back up, and the words go across the screen that say 4 years later. Because the events that happen in chapter 1 precede the events of chapter 2. It looks like it's all together, but we'll find out when we get to chapter 2, verse 16, that actually 4 years have passed. And it's a significant 4 years because it was during that time that Xerxes makes his assault on Athens. And And, you know, what looked like was going to be a decisive battle for him, he rolled into that territory and had some great successes, ultimately ended up falling apart for him. There was a decisive naval battle, which the Athenians were able to mount, and so it thwarted what Xerxes was trying to do. All of a sudden, there were rebellions in the provinces back in Persia, so Xerxes had to leave, and the troops had to withdraw, and it was the end of that scenario. And so when he comes back to Persia, it's in defeat. It's with, you know, with revolts that he's had to squelch. It's with his coffers being much lighter, because war is a very costly thing. So as we start chapter 2, things have not gone well for the king. And I just want to read the first 4 verses of chapter 2, and that's where we'll quit tonight. It says, "After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what he had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, 'Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti.' This thing pleased the king, and he did so." Okay, that's where we'll stop. So he's licking his wounds from this disastrous Athenian campaign, and Ahasuerus starts missing Vashti. All of a sudden, as he comes back and he's looking around and the house is empty and nobody's cooked dinner, and he's thinking, "Oh man, you know, what did I do? What was that all about? Why did I was so rough on her? I mean, you know, it was 4 years ago and I've been drinking and the whole thing." And so he's feeling bad about what happened, which could easily have led him to want to undo what he had done, to try to find some way to restore her. And his advisors knew where this was going to go, and this was going to be trouble. And so they immediately jump in there and say, no, let's follow through with your original plan. Let's find somebody to replace her, because you couldn't break a Persian law. That would have been dreadful for the whole governmental structure. So they proposed that they're going to have kind of like a Miss Persia contest, or maybe the Persian version of The Bachelor, whatever. The idea is they're going to go round up all the pretty girls and find all the prettiest ones in the land. Now, here's where it kind of sounds like a fairy tale, huh? A proclamation goes out through all the land. The prettiest come to the king's court, and beauty preparations, you know, like a big spa. This is awesome. But we don't want to... We don't want to over-romanticize this, because there's nothing in this that indicates that any of this was voluntary. So we're talking about soldiers walking through the streets, going house to house saying, "We're the pretty ones," you know, and taking them away from families, from fathers, from mothers. Some of them are going to be very young, taken into the king's harem and left there, and we'll find out later, left there for a year. You know, a year-long spa might sound kind of good, but when you're off by yourself, separated from the ones you love, with an uncertain future, because what this is all preparation for is, it says there that a woman who pleases him is going to be the next king. All of this year-long spa and preparation, taken from your own, taken from your family, is leading up to one night that you're going to spend with a king. And if he has enjoyed himself, you get to be queen. But if he has not, you go back to the harem. And that means you belong to the king. You're no longer, you know, I'm sorry guys, but you're no longer a virgin after that night. And so you go back to the harem, where you now belong to the king, and you are in essence a widow. You live without a husband. You live in the confines of that harem. You don't go out by yourself. You don't go or have any kind of life. You have no promise of a husband or a friend or a companion. It's a dire consequence for the one who doesn't win the pageant. And so the stakes are high. So there's where it's all set up. This was all the preparation for the next characters that are going to be introduced in the story, and we'll see what unfolds that way. Right on?